In spite of the fact that there was no more danger, there was not much chance of deep sleep for the rest of the night. The morning sun was greeted with a general sense of relief as Joanna rustled up some breakfast while Clint and Carl loaded packs and saddled horses. Clint checked on the bodies again, ridding them of weapons and ammunition before breaking camp and leaving the tragic scene behind them. A clear day before him and the anticipation of reuniting with brother and uncle served to lighten the atmosphere for the travelers. But Carl would never forget the machine-like reactions of his young friend in the execution of the two men. He would also remember his daughters clinging to Clint instead of running to her father. That could signal trouble ahead. Later in the day, they came upon a cabin occupied by the Weber family. The friendly settlers happily told them that if they kept following the river, Frederick Steiner's house would be the next house they came to. They rode about 3/4 of a mile before they spotted a sturdy log house where a creek emptied into the river. There was a large garden in front of the house with a man and a boy cleaning out a couple of rows of dead vines.
Freddy!
Frederick looked up, startled by the sudden appearance of the group on horseback.
Carl!
Frederick turned quickly to his son.
As I live and breathe, it's your Uncle Carl.
Dropping his hoe, he ran to meet his brother. Carl jumped out of the saddle, and the two brothers embraced.
I swear, I never thought you'd come out here. What happened to the gold mining? And you brought Joanna and Robert with you. Where's Sarah?
Carl paused but a moment to shake hands with his nephew, Johann.
Well, the truth is, I brought Joanna. Robert went back east. Sarah's dead, killed by Sioux Indians.
Oh, my Lord. I can't believe Sarah's gone. I'm so sorry, Carl. And Robert, too?
Like I said, Robert took off after the Indians hit us. Left Joanna to her fate.
Well, who is this fellow with her?
Oh, his name's Clint Connor. But, truth be told, he's an angel sent down to bring Joanna and me safely here.
Uncle Freddy!
Joanna gave her uncle a big hug. Within minutes, the party was joined by Frederick's wife, Bertha, and the round of hugs was started all over again. Clint held back and watched the reunion, smiling. After Frederick told Bertha about the death of her sister-in-law, Carl beckoned for Clint to come forward to be introduced.
Welcome to my home, Mr. Connor.
Frederick extended his hand.
Carl told me he was owing to you for seeing him and Joanna safely here.
It's Clint. I was coming to Montana anyway.
Well, let's don't stand out here in the garden. Come on up to the house and we'll find you folks something to eat.
I'd be obliged if I could turn these horses out in your corral.
Sure. Johann can help you with those saddles and packs.
His son stepped forward to shake hands with Clint. While Clint and Johann took care of the horses, the others went in the house as Carl explained Clint's presence and the absence of Robert. He told them about the futile attempts to pan gold in the Black Hills, the subsequent attacks by Indians, and the latest attempt upon their lives by outlaws.
But thanks to Clint's help, we finally made it here.
I hope you've come to stay. We've got a fine little farming community started here.
That's what we had in mind. I hoped that I could find some good land and go back to farming.
I'd take it as a godsend if you'd think about staying here with us. To tell you the truth, I took on a bigger piece of land than I can handle. With just Johann and me, it's more than I can keep up with. I could sure use some help. What do you say, Carl? We can build on the back of the house so you and Joanna can have your own space, and we'll run this place together.
Sounds good to me.
Carl and Frederick shook on it while Bertha and Joanna beamed their approval.
Oh, you couldn't have come at a better time. I've got a field full of oats that are just about ready to harvest. Johann and I were going to ask Weber next door if he could give us a hand. Now we won't have to.
At that moment, Clint walked in clean shaven and washed. He immediately felt a sudden flush of embarrassment as he witnessed the startled expressions on the faces of the women.
I thought I'd best clean up a little bit.
Bertha glanced at Joanna and grinned before turning back to behold the minor transformation of their guest. Joanna's look of astonishment slowly turned to a pleased smile.
Sit yourself down at the table. We're about ready to eat.
As they all sat around the supper table, Clint was told of the plans for the two brothers to go into partnership on the land. Clint felt that his obligation to Carl and Joanna was completed. His main concern had been for Joanna, and he now felt she was safe and with people who cared for her.
I reckon I'll be moving on in the morning.
Joanna tried to hide the look of distress that suddenly registered upon her face. No one noticed it except Bertha, who smiled her understanding.
Well, what are you gonna do?
I guess I'm just gonna see what I can see.
Which way are you heading?
I expect I'll look around this part of the country for a little bit, and then head on west. I've got a strong notion to see the Rocky Mountains. Maybe find me a spot on top of a mountain someplace where there's plenty of game for food and hides.
And just live like a wild man?
I reckon.
Clint could not tell her that he felt he had no choice. The image of Zack Clayton entered his mind while the deputy marshal vowed to come after him. Then it suddenly hit him like a punch in the solar plexus. For the first time since his escape from prison, he wished with all his heart that he had served his sentence, that he was free to do whatever he wanted without fear of running into a lawman. He looked up then to discover Joanna's gaze fixed upon him.
Maybe it ain't the way I want it.
Don't feel like you have to go right away. You're welcome to stay on a while until you get rested up and maybe get a few good meals in you. Bertha's a very good cook.
I wouldn't want to be a bother.
Oh, it's no bother. Seems to me we owe you more than that.
Joanna said nothing, but watched Clint's reactions closely, waiting for his response.
Well, if you don't think I'd be a burden, I might stay on for a couple days.
Joanna quickly turned her face away, afraid they might read the relief in it. When it was time for bed, Bertha suggested that Clint could sleep in the kitchen by the stove, since the cabin was lacking in enough rooms for everyone. Clint graciously declined, saying he would be fine in the barn with his horses.
Joanna, why don't you take a lantern and go out with Clint so he can see to spread his bedroll?
Johann can do that.
I want Johann to help me set up some beds for you. Joanna can do it.
You don't need to bother with that. I reckon I...
Come on.
Taking the lantern Bertha offered, Joanna started for the door.
You don't want to spread your bedroll over something one of those horses left on the floor.
Joanna held the lantern for Clint while he untied his bedroll from his saddle and spread it on some hay in a corner of the last stall.
Well, I reckon that'll do just fine. I appreciate the help.
You're welcome. I haven't really had a chance to tell you how much I owe you. We owe you, Papa and I, for coming with us.
When he started to protest that it wasn't necessary, she stopped him.
Clint, I owe you my life. I will always be grateful. And I'll never forget what you did for me.
I'm just glad I came along when I did.
So am I.
Clint looked up to meet her gaze.
Thank you.
Joanna quickly reached up and kissed him lightly on the lips, then spun around and left him, standing confused in the dark. Clint went to bed then, but he did not sleep for some time, his mind laboring now with thoughts new to him, the memory still lingering of her lips on his. He could not deny that he had come to look upon the woman fondly, but he had attributed his feelings to compassion for her misfortunes. He tried to recreate the incident in his mind. Her kiss had been quick, maybe really only on the corner of his lips. She might have intended to kiss him on the cheek, actually, as a sister would kiss her brother, and accidentally came too close to his lips.
Oh, forget about it. She's just grateful to you for saving her life.
Three days out of Fort Laramie, Zack Clayton followed an old trail that the Army often used when heading north through Powder River country. He did not particularly like the idea that the three fugitives he was after had a sizable head start, but it didn't cause him excessive worry either. A man confident in his ability to do his job, he knew he would strike their trail somewhere, and that he would prevail in the end. He didn't have to continue his pursuit of the three escapees into Montana. The job could have been passed off to the marshal in that territory, but he had volunteered to go after him to finish the job he should already have completed. He had never failed to bring in a fugitive he'd been sent after, and he didn't want these three to be on his record. Aside from that, he felt a strong desire to rid the world of Clell Ballinger and Pete Yancey. The other one, the young man, well, he almost wished he could let him go, but he knew that he couldn't. He quickly put the thoughts aside when he spotted a single rider crossing a low mesa directly ahead of him. At that distance, it was impossible to determine if it was Indian or white, but it paid to be cautious until finding out which. He drew his rifle from the saddle sling. Seeming to be in no particular hurry, the rider came down from the mesa to intercept the trail Clayton was following. Instead of crossing it, he turned onto it, now heading straight for the deputy marshal. Clayton watched the rider carefully. As he came closer, he at first thought it to be an Indian. But when the rider approached within 100 yards, a grin crept slowly across Clayton's face.
Billy Turnipseed.
Clayton waited until Billy was just about even with the mouth of the ravine before suddenly riding up out of it to startle the unsuspecting little man. As he approached, Billy stopped his horse and started to fumble with his saddlebag trying to get out his rifle. Before he could get it halfway out, Clayton was already on him.
If I was a Sioux warrior, you'd already be buzzard bait, Billy.
Ooh. Damn you, Zack Clayton! You lucky I didn't shoot you!
I ain't worried about no Sioux warriors anyway. I ain't got no trouble with Injuns. I knew there was somebody hiding in that ravine from way back yonder.
Yeah, I could tell by the way you damn near fell off that crow bait you're riding.
You're doing up this way. Chasing after some poor soul, I reckon.
That's a fact. I'm looking for two lowlifes, all right. One of them broke out of prison, name of Clell Ballinger, and his sidekick, Pete Yancey. You ain't run into him, have you?
Nah, I ain't seen him. I ain't seen no white men for a spell. I've been living with Angry Bear's folks on the Horn up until he moved his village to join up with old Sitting Bull. But just come from the Big Horns. The only folks I seen was three folks headed to some settlement on the Yellowstone. A young couple and an old man. Yeah, I think the old man was the woman's pappy. Anyway, I wouldn't bet on them making it. They didn't know where they were or which way they were heading. I had to tell them where to go. They'll be damn lucky if they don't meet up with a Lakota war party.
Is that so? It's a hell of a time for three white people to be traveling this territory alone. Did you catch their names?
Nah. Oh. The pappy's name was Claude, something like that. Now, the other one, the young one, his name was Clint. Yep, Clint something.
Clint Connor?
Yeah, might have been. That sounds right.
Riding a buckskin?
Ooh, matter of fact.
Where'd you meet these folks? How long ago?
2 or 3 days ago.
Tell me exactly where you met up with these folks and which way you sent them.
Billy told Clayton all he remembered about his overnight visit with the three travelers he met on the Little Powder. When he had finished, there was no doubt in Zack's mind that the young man Billy had camped with was Clint Connor. Still, it left him in a bit of a quandary. He was much more concerned with capturing Ballinger and Yancey than he was with Connor. He was convinced that Clint was not likely to cause anyone any trouble, while the other two were apt to murder and steal. To be considered, however, was the fact that he could only guess where Ballinger and Yancey were, and he knew now where Connor was, or at least thereabouts. He was sworn to bring all three in, so the sensible thing to do was go after Connor before he took off somewhere else. He wasn't happy about it, but he decided to go after the bird in hand. It was a pleasant time for Clint Connor, the first such time in several years. At Frederick and Bertha's insistence, as well as because of his personal desire, he stayed on for longer than the couple of days he first proposed. The Steiner brothers were happy to have his help harvesting the oats, and he gained a constant admirer in the person of 13-year-old Johann. Nothing beyond polite conversation took place between Joanna and him as far as vocal communication was concerned, but for those who more closely observed, Bertha in particular, the silent signals of deeper thoughts were blatantly evident. It was inevitable that these thoughts and questions would come to surface between the two young people. When the harvesting was finished, Clint spent more time with his horses, figuring that Rowdy and the other horses were getting fat and lazy while he'd been working in the fields. Joanna walked out to the corral one afternoon when she saw him saddling the buckskin.
Where are you off to?
Nowhere in particular. Just thought I'd ride a little of the rust off of Rowdy. I reckon all of them need a little exercise.
If you'll saddle that little mare, I'll ride with you. I'm not ready to start supper yet, and I'd enjoy a ride. Oh, unless you don't care for any company.
No, ma'am. I'd be glad to have your company.
Good. I'll just go tell Aunt Bertha I'm going.
Joanna raced to her bedroom.
Aunt Bertha, I'm gonna go help Clint exercise his horses.
You take your time, honey!
Joanna fretted over her appearance in the mirror.
Why were you born so damn plain?
She pinched her cheeks and smoothed her hair.
Would it have been asking too much for a little less forehead and a little more chin?
She traced her fingertip along the one scar that remained after her abduction by the three Sioux warriors. Aunt Bertha had told her that it was hardly noticeable, but to Joanna it stood out like a brand. Seeing it always reminded her of the circumstances under which it was received.
It's the best I can do.
You young folks, enjoy your ride!
Joanna responded with an embarrassed smile. At that moment, Frederick entered the house, bumping into Joanna.
Whoa! Oh,
sorry, Uncle.
Where's she heading in such a hurry?
Just going for a ride with Clint.
I don't know about that. Joanna's a married woman.
Oh, bull feathers! If she's married, where's her husband? I never thought Robert Becker was good enough for Joanna anyway. I'm not surprised he ran away at the first sign of trouble. Besides, I like that boy. I think they'd make a good pair.
Clint and Joanna started out following the wagon track that led to the third house in the line of families that came out together from Omaha. Leaving the road at the corner of Frederick's property, they continued on following the river. As he looked across the Yellowstone, it was apparent to Clint why all the settlement was on this side of the river, for high rolling hills began at the very bluffs on the far side and extended as far as the eye could see. After about an hour, they came upon a little island at a bend in the river. With several large willow trees and separated from the riverbank by only a dozen yards of shallow water, it looked to be a pleasant place to rest while the horses drank. He cast a questioning glance in Joanna's direction, and she, understanding, nodded.
Probably ought to let the horses drink.
Clint guided Rowdy down into the water. She followed him across to the island, and they dismounted.
Oh, what a lovely little island. I should have brought along a picnic basket.
She found a grass-covered hummock and sat down to enjoy the late August sun, knowing there would not be many warm days left to enjoy before the winds began to chill. She watched Clint as he led the horses up from the water and dropped their reins, standing by him while they began to graze on the lush grass. She felt safe and comfortable, remembering the days when they were always looking over their shoulders, wondering if Sioux warriors were in pursuit. After a few moments, he walked over to stand by her.
I expect we best turn back before before your aunt starts to worry about you.
She knows I'm all right as long as I'm with you. It's so nice here. Let's stay for a little while longer.
There were thoughts running through her mind that she told herself she should not be thinking. Thoughts that he might even be appalled to know. In truth, he had never exhibited particular interest in her as a woman, a fact she couldn't help but attribute to her plain features and her soiled past. He might have the same feelings that Robert had about women who had been with Indians.
This is a right peaceful spot.
Clint sat down in the grass beside her. They talked for a while about the land and her father's plans to farm it with her uncle. Clint talked about the possibility of raising cattle and horses on the endless grasslands, and the talks with her uncle of rumors that the railroad would soon come out this far. After a lull in the conversation occurred, Joanna asked the question to which she was most interested in gaining an answer.
Are you, thinking about staying here to raise your horses?
Well, to tell you the truth, I hadn't planned to when we first got here.
Oh, but, now?
Well, no, I ain't so sure. This is nice country. As good a place as any, I reckon. I mean, if there was some way to know if I should stay or not.
You mean, whether or not I want you to stay?
His face registered the helplessness he felt, reluctant to admit that she had exposed his hidden thoughts.
I've got no right.
Because I do. I want you to stay.
The look on his face told her that he was indeed not repelled by her, but quite the opposite. Smiling as she looked into his eyes, she took his hand in hers, held it for a moment, then guided it around her waist. Leaning into him, she kissed him. This time, it was no light kiss, and it left him with no doubt of the intent behind the caress. He took her in his arms, passionately returning her kiss, shutting out all feelings of guilt, overcome by the moment, and hardly believing it was happening. With both parties knowing where it would lead and anxious to arrive, he laid her back on the warm bed of grass where she eagerly answered his urgent needs. After they had reached passion's promise, they lay back together, she in his arms, content to stay there forever with her head resting upon his shoulder. The thought struck her at that moment that this was the first time she had really felt such passion, realizing that Robert had never taken her to such heights. For a brief moment, she allowed thoughts of guilt to creep into her mind, but immediately she rejected them, hoping to banish them forever, in fact. She had honored her marriage vows. Robert had discarded her and left her to her shame. Now, like a candle suddenly lit in a dark cave, she saw new promise where before there was none. And she realized the honesty of it. Clint knew of her shame and accepted her without baggage from the past. It occurred to her then that she was in love, maybe for the first time. They remained there, she with her head on his shoulder for some time, until Rowdy became impatient and strolled over to rub his muzzle on Clint's stomach.
I guess he's telling me it's time to get going back.
Clint sat up and watched for a moment while Joanna, slightly embarrassed now, recovered her clothing. He realized then there was something he must tell her, reluctant though he might be. Sensing a seriousness come over him, she paused to look him in the eye.
Joanna, I've got to tell you something.
If you're about to tell me this was all a big mistake, I don't want to hear it.
Something I should have told you from the first.
Oh, now that we've had our little roll in the grass, you remember that there was an Indian there before you.
No, that ain't it at all. I don't fault you for that. Hell, it wasn't your doing.
Then what? Well, you just remembered you got a little wife waiting for you back in Wyoming? Well, guess what? I got a husband somewhere, too. You're not the only one with a guilty conscience.
No, damn it. Just shut up a minute and let me finish.
She realized then that her insecurities had again taken control of her emotions because of a dread of rejection and fear that she had been used to simply give him physical relief. When she indicated that she was calmly awaiting what he felt he had to say, he revealed that which he had been reluctant to tell.
I'm an escaped convict from the Wyoming Territorial Prison.
Almost staggered by his statement, she nevertheless showed no alarm and heard him out as he told her his story and how he happened to be on his way to Montana when he came upon her. Although still astonished by his confession, she was not horrified by the time he had explained everything.
You mean you were sent to prison, really, because of compassion for a horse?
Well, it wasn't just any horse. It was an Appaloosa gelding that trusted me. And I couldn't let that horse take the abuse he was getting from the judge's foreman.
And that's the only crime you've committed? They sent you to prison for that?
Was. Until a few weeks ago when I stole the horse I escaped prison on.
But 6 years? Isn't that a long time for just setting one horse free?
I reckon not if it's the judge's horse.
She trusted her instincts that told her he was a decent man who had been dealt a cruel hand by fate. She thought of the man who had come to her rescue, risking his life repeatedly to save her and her father. She remembered the firm but gentle hand that had seen her safely home to find her mother dead and her husband gone. The vigilant guide that saw her and her father safely to this country. This was not the work of a common horse thief. These were traits found in a decent, honest man. She decided that she accepted his story completely, and knowing he anxiously awaited her verdict, she told him as much.
What happened here today was supposed to happen. It'll be our secret until we have time to think about what should happen next.
She gazed at the imprint in the soft grass where they had lain, then looked around her at the fragile willows.
This place will always be our special place.
She was certain then of what she wanted to happen, but decided to be careful about mentioning marriage and family until she really knew the seriousness of his intentions. As for him, he was still in somewhat of a mystified daze, still finding it hard to believe that it had happened.
That's Clint.
Putting the horses away. I thought I'd better help you with supper.
Did you have a nice ride?
Yeah, it was quite pleasant.
Looks like it put a little rosy in your cheeks.
Oh, really? Oh, the wind, I guess.
Probably. Maybe you might want to change your skirt, though. On tomorrow, when I do the wash, we'll see if we can get some of those grass stains off of the back of it.
Oh!
Joanna flushed scarlet and twisted around, trying to see the back of her skirt.
I don't know how that happened. I think I did that this morning when I was gathering the eggs.
Most likely. Hurry and change, and you can set the table.
At supper that night, no one observed the frequent glances between Joanna and Clint. No one with the exception of Bertha, who very seldom missed anything. As for Clint, he felt a huge weight had been lifted from his shoulders, having confessed his dark secret to Joanna and knowing she believed in his innocence. Supper was especially enjoyable on this occasion.
What'll it be, mister?
The owner of Gordy's Saloon, a short, bald, heavyset man, wiped the rough bar with his dirty rag. Zach Clayton took a moment to look around the empty room.
What have you got that won't kill a man?
Well, I don't serve nothing but the best whiskey I can get.
Well, I'll take a chance on a shot of it.
Gordy looked his customer over while he poured Clayton's drink. When he set the bottle down on the bar, Clayton eyed the shot glass carefully.
I figure if I'm paying for a shot, I expect to get a full shot. How about filling that glass the rest of the way?
That is a full shot around here.
Gordy reluctantly filled the glass.
Much obliged.
Clayton tossed the whiskey down. Fiery liquid scalded his throat, leaving him with tears in his eyes and speechless for a few seconds.
If that's the best you can get, I won't complain about a half-full glass next time. Damn!
Gordy grinned, satisfied with a small measure of revenge.
I ain't seen you in these parts before.
Last time I was up this way, there was nothing but a few tents here.
Zack opened his coat to display his badge.
I'm a deputy marshal, and I'm looking for a man that might have come through here a week or so ago. He was traveling with another man and a woman. Young feller.
Gordy knew exactly who he was referring to, but he was not in the habit of helping the law.
I seen him. He was in here for a drink, but I don't know where he come from or where he went.
Clayton had a feeling the bartender knew more than he was telling, but he nodded his thanks and went on his way. He rode comfortably, not asking for more than a leisurely walk from the chestnut roan he rode. There had been changes since last he was in this part of the territory, with a cluster of tents and shacks that was almost enough to be called a town. When he came upon a trading post that he remembered, close by the bank of the river, he decided to stop. Hitching his horse at the rail out front, he took a look around before going inside. When he had been there 2 years before, there had been a stack of hides, buffalo, beaver, deer, piled high at the side of the building. Now, there were only a few skins in a stack no more than waist high. The thing that surprised him most was the sight of a couple of plows resting against the building. Inside, the trading post looked more like a dry goods store with tools and harnesses and bolts of calico, in addition to the regular stock of cartridges, skin and knives, and traps, all evidence of civilization approaching. Before asking about Clint Connor, he made conversation with the clerk, a young man who, it turned out, was the son-in-law the proprietor Clayton had remembered. Clayton decided to comment about the changes he'd noticed on the way in.
Well, yes, sir. The business in hides is way down from what it used to be, but we've got more settlers moving in every month, so we're selling more dry goods. The army had some surveyors in here just a month ago. They're thinking about establishing a fort here. We might have us a town before you know it.
You might be right.
Clayton then identified himself as a deputy marshal and described Clint Connor.
I've got a real important message for him. I'm just hoping he's still around here somewhere. You seen him lately?
Well, matter of fact, I have. He came in yesterday with Frederick Steiner's boy, Johan, to buy some sugar and flour. I knew I hadn't seen him before. He said he was just visiting for a spell.
Well, old Clint will be tickled to see me. Maybe you can tell me how to get out to Steiner, did you say?
Oh, yes, sir. Frederick Steiner. Just stay on the road by the river about 3 miles. It'll be the second house after you cross Wolf Creek.
These folks, the Steiners, you know them pretty well?
Oh, yes, sir. They're fine people. Said they were German. They're farming a few hundred acres by the river. There was 3 families that came out here together, and they've been trading with me right regular.
Appreciate it.
Frederick Steiner was standing on his porch when the stranger rode up and dismounted.
How do?
Howdy. Is Clint around?
Clint? You know Clint?
Sure do. Is he around?
Why, I think he's in the pond.
Frederick's son, hearing his dad talking to someone, came out on the porch. Frederick turned to him.
Johan, go out to the barn and fetch Clint.
Johan nodded and jumped off the porch.
You ride out from the settlement?
Yes, sir, I did.
Why don't you come on in the house and sit down while Johan fetches Clint? Maybe we've got some coffee still in the pot.
That would be real nice.
It was the first time he had ever used this approach in making an arrest, but he was confident that he knew his man. Connor was not a killer. He was convinced that he was a decent man who had just taken a step in the wrong direction. It was fairly obvious that these folks had no inkling of Clint's past. As for confronting Clint, Clayton felt the best place to keep the arrest from getting nasty was in the midst of the family who had evidently taken him in. He figured Clint wouldn't want to involve the family in any violent action. Following Frederick inside, he nodded to Carl and the two women, all with puzzled expressions to greet him. A short while later, after he accepted a cup of coffee from Joanna, Johann came in through the front door.
Clint ain't there. I don't know where he is.
He was there a minute ago, Johann.
God damn it!
Suddenly, Clayton sprang up from his chair, realizing he'd been recognized. He rushed to the door and ran toward the corral.
That's far enough.
Clint appeared in the barn door. Rowdy, already saddled, stood between him and the deputy marshal. Clint's Winchester was resting across the saddle and aimed straight at Clayton.
Hello, Clint. Here you are. Point a rifle in my face again.
Zach took a couple of steps more, but he stopped when Clint cocked the rifle.
Last time I saw you, you helped me out of a jam and then made me take a hell of a long walk. My feet were sore for a week.
You shouldn't have come after me. Why the hell couldn't you just leave me alone?
Glancing behind the lawman, he was disappointed to see Joanna and the others come out behind him. The expressions of alarm and dismay in their faces brought a feeling of great regret to his troubled mind. Reading Clint's expression, Clayton took a quick glance to confirm what he suspected. They didn't know of Clint's past, with the possible exception of the young woman. Knowing their presence here now was to his advantage, he made an attempt to reason with the fugitive.
I don't know how much you've told these nice folks here, so I'll spell it out for them. You're an escaped prisoner from the Wyoming Territorial Prison. That's the reason I had to come track you down. But I'm ready to tell these folks that I know you're a good man. You made a mistake when you weren't much more than a boy. Stole a horse, but you only served half your sentence. If you come back with me peaceable, I'll do whatever I can to help you. I figure I owe you that, seeing as how you saved my neck back there north of Cheyenne. I'll testify about that to the judge. That and that little stunt you pulled to save the guard's life.
He gestured toward the stunned gathering behind him.
Your friends here probably don't know you had no choice about escaping with Ballinger. I'll remind the judge of that, too.
I've served enough time for freeing one horse from the treatment Judge Plover gave it. I ain't going back.
You know I'm bound to take you back.
What are you gonna do? Shoot me?
You ain't no murderer, Clint. And you don't want to be on the run for the rest of your life. You've already served half your time, and I'm thinking the judge will shorten the rest of your sentence when I testify for you. The best thing for you to do is to wipe the slate clean with the law. Come out in a short time a free man.
Although the Winchester was still pointed at him, Clayton thought he detected a hint of indecision in Clint's eyes.
Let's talk about it. I don't want this to come to bloodshed, but I've got no choice in what I have to do. I just hate to see you make a mess out of your life.
Clint was torn with anguish. He wished that he had had more time to think about it. There were other factors that entered into his decisions now, the most important of which was Joanna. He had seen a glimmer of what might have been, and at this moment, he knew that it could never be if he was constantly on the run. He took his eyes off Clayton long enough to cast an inquiring glance in her direction. Her face, filled with distress, answered his unspoken question with a nod of her head, and she mouthed the silent words, "I'll wait for you." Still uncertain, Clint pulled the rifle down from his saddle.
You don't have to go anywhere with him.
Johann Steiner stepped up behind Clayton with a shotgun leveled at the deputy's waist.
We'll ride up in the Badlands where nobody can find us.
Johann!
Frederick started toward his son, but Johann waved him and his mother back while keeping the shotgun trained on Zach Clayton. Realizing the consequences that were sure to follow Johann's actions and the certain ruination of the young boy's life, Clint knew what he had to do.
Johann, the deputy's right. Put the gun down. It's best I go back and clear this mark against my name.
But we can make it, Clint. I'll help you.
I know you would, and I appreciate it. But it ain't the right thing to do. You heard what Clayton said. I won't be gone long, and your pa needs you here.
He waited until the boy lowered the shotgun. Then he turned to Clayton.
I reckon you win.
I expect it would be best to go ahead and get started.
He could see little sense in lingering there where there might be too many things to cause Clint to have a change of heart. He held out his hand for Clint's rifle.
Whatever you say.
Clint surrendered the weapon.
I'm ready.
If we run into any engines, I'll give it back. Might as well let me hold on to that pistol, too.
Clint handed over the gun as well. Then Zack extended his hand again, this time to shake Clint's.
I give you my word that I'll do everything I can for you in court, and I'd appreciate it if you give me yours, that you won't cause me any more trouble on the way back.
Clint nodded and shook on it. It was a strange turn of events. A parting unlike any the deputy marshal had ever experienced before while in the process of making an arrest. Bertha quickly gathered some food for him to take, and Carl filled a sack with oats for the horses. Clayton did not tie Clint's hands or feet. It was more like two friends starting out for home after a visit. He stood by his horse while Clint spoke his final farewells. After Clint thanked Frederick and Bertha for their hospitality, he shook hands with Carl, who told him he was doing the right thing. Next, he shook young Johann's hand and charged him with the responsibility of taking care of his horses and the guns and ammunition that he had acquired after the confrontations with the Sioux and the two bushwhackers from the saloon.
When I get back, we'll go up in the hills across the river and get us an elk.
Joanna held back while he said goodbye to the others. When he turned to find her, she stepped forward and, much to the astonishment of the males in her family, threw her arms around Clint's neck. Pulling his head down to her, she kissed him with all the ardor she held in her heart. Clint never wanted this moment to end. But Joanna finally released him.
I'll be right here when you get back.
I'll surely be back.
Clint turned, mounted his horse, and started rowdy toward where Clayton was waiting. Taking one last look at Joanna, he turned the buckskin toward the road and left. Clayton tipped his hat politely to the two women, nodded to the men, and urged his horse to lope until he caught up with his prisoner. Side by side, they settled into a comfortable walk and headed to Cheyenne. Covering 30 to 40 miles a day, they drove a steady pace down through the Powder River Valley, riding until they exhausted daylight in an effort to pass through the still dangerous territory. The great village of Sioux and Cheyenne that had annihilated Custer on the Little Bighorn had long since splintered off into many different directions, but there was always the good possibility that many were still in the area, causing both men to watch constantly for any sign of hostile groups. At night, the campfire was kept low, out of sight in a gully or other defile where possible, so as not to attract any curious Lakota hunter. Since the trip would take better than a week and a half, there was plenty of opportunity for the two men to get to know each other a little better. The first night out, Clayton had tried to sleep with one eye open. He trusted Clint at his word, but there was the nagging thought that he might change his mind after being away from that little lady back in Montana. There was no sense in taking a chance on losing him again. But he finally threw precaution to the wind after the fourth day when he developed stomach cramps from eating the last of the meat Bertha had given him, the meat having spoiled after that length of time. They lost half a day's travel when Clayton was too sick to get out of his blankets. Clint had the opportunity to do pretty well whatever he wanted to, but he chose to help the stricken man as best he could, never giving any thought of escape. After that, Clayton gave Clint's rifle and pistol back. Trying to make up for lost time, they pushed the horses hard the following day, never stopping until it was almost too dark to see. Guiding the horses down a rocky path cut by the narrow spring, they selected the best spot they could find in the growing darkness, and they made their camp. After they'd taken care of the horses, there was a little time spent sitting by the fire before turning in for the night. Clint roasted a little jerky for his supper. Clayton, his stomach still a bit tender after his bout with the tainted meat, settled for coffee alone. The notch between the two buttes ran east to west, so the first rays of the morning sun shone directly down it, lighting tiny sparks that danced upon the water. It was a peaceful place. Clayton opened his eyes to find himself looking into the muzzle of a pistol pointed directly at his head. He froze, helpless to react fast enough and knowing he was a dead man.
Don't move.
Stunned, unable to believe Clint had missed at point-blank range, he rolled out of his blanket trying to scramble to his feet, his mind a whirlwind of chaotic thoughts. When he managed to get his gun out, he stopped, puzzled by Clint's calm, smiling face as he pointed toward Clayton's bedroll and the 5-foot rattlesnake lying dead beside it.
Maybe we ought to be a little more careful where we make our beds.
Clint holstered his pistol. Clayton was flat-out stricken dumb for a few seconds, gaping wide-eyed first at the snake and then at Clint.
God damn! God damn!
Clayton shook his head over and over as if trying to rid it of his alarm.
I came mighty close to shitting the rest of that meat in my britches. Why couldn't you just wake me up and tell me?
Tell you the truth, that snake must have crawled up between you and the fire to get warm. But I was afraid if you moved, it might have struck. Besides, it wasn't that close. He must have been 6 or 7 inches from your head.
Is that all?
They made the trip in 11 days with half a day lost because of Clayton's sick spell and 2 delays where Sioux hunting parties were spotted. Bypassing Fort Laramie, they retraced the trail Clint had taken on his way to Montana weeks before.
Well, where are you taking me? Laramie?
No, I'm supposed to take you to Cheyenne. You'll have to go to trial there since that's where you were sentenced. Then I expect you'll be sent back to Laramie as soon as the trial is over.
He watched Clint's face closely, wondering whether, now that they were within a couple of days' ride, he might be getting cold feet about returning to prison.
Maybe they'll give you your old cell back. It'll be like coming home, but I don't expect you'll be put on stable duty again.
I don't reckon. It's the broom factory for me.
Judge Wingate is a reasonable man. I think when he hears all the facts in your case, you'll be out of there before that little gal of yours has a good chance to miss you.
What'll happen to my horse and the rest of my stuff?
Well, guns and saddle most likely go to the sheriff's office till they decide something else to do with them. They'll put your horse in the stable, for a while anyway. Then they may ship him to Laramie. I ain't really sure.
These guns and the saddle belong to my pa, the horse, too. Any way he can claim them?
I don't know. I'll find out.
Clint had not spent a great deal of time thinking about the problem. Now, he wished that he had ridden one of the Indian ponies he had captured and left Rowdy in Montana. He didn't like the thought of the buckskin being turned out with a bunch of prison horses. Sheriff Quentin Bridges took delivery of Clayton's prisoner and locked him in a cell to await trial. Clayton informed the sheriff that Clint was a good man, and he warned him that he'd better damn sure treat him proper. He came back to check on Clint that same day.
I've notified Judge Wingate's office and wired the prison over at Laramie that you're in custody. They promised me that Judge Wingate would try the case within a couple of days, so you shouldn't be here too long. You all right?
Yep, I'm all right. I've been in jail before.
Okay, then.
Clayton got up from the stool he had pulled over next to the bars.
I'll be back to see how you're doing.
On his way out, he spoke to the sheriff.
I'll see you later, Quentin. Take care of my boy in there.
I will.
The sheriff walked back to the cell and spoke to Clint.
Son, you must have something on old Zach. I never seen him worry about a prisoner like this before. More times than not, they're pretty bloody when he brings them in.
The trial date was set, and on the scheduled day, Sheriff Bridges handcuffed the prisoner and escorted him across the street to the courtroom. As Bridges led him to his seat, Clint nodded to Zach Clayton on the other side of the room. Seated in the room of curious spectators, he awaited the arrival of the judge. He had to wait for nearly half an hour.
All rise!
Sitting stoically to that point, Clint suddenly felt a jolt throughout his whole body when the judge entered the room. It was Judge Wyman Plover.
What?
He started to surge forward, causing the sheriff to grab him and pull him back.
Whoa, boy. Where you going?
That's that son of a bitch Plover. It's supposed to be Judge Wingate.
Plover's filling in for Wingate. Judge Wingate came down ill yesterday, and Judge Plover rode in this morning to try the case for him.
You may be seated.
Judge Wyman Plover glared at the sheriff and Clint over the top of his spectacles.
Sheriff, settle your prisoner down over there.
It would be one of the shortest trials Sheriff Bridges could remember. The entire proceedings were finished in less than an hour. When Deputy Marshal Clayton was called to the stand, he asked to speak to the court on behalf of the prisoner. Judge Plover instructed him to respond to his questions with answers of yes or no. When he tried to testify on the cooperation of the prisoner and his willingness to risk his life to save that of the deputy, Clayton was told that his testimony was irrelevant to the charges against Clint.
We're here to decide whether the defendant escaped from the territorial penitentiary or not. And you've already testified that he did. Added to those charges is assault with intent to kill prison guard Otis Williams.
But, Your Honor, Clint...
You, sir, are in danger of contempt.
The defendant saved that guard's life.
You will leave my courtroom now. If you do not, you will join Mr. Connor in one of my cells.
The deputy marshal had no choice but to do as he was ordered.
Now then, we will get on with this trial. Mr. Connor, you will stand for your sentencing. Clint Allen Connor, it is the ruling of this court that you shall be returned to the Wyoming Territorial Prison, where you will serve the remaining 3 years and 1 month of your original sentence. In addition, you will serve 2 years in punishment for your escape. And 5 years for the attempted assault on the guard. This case is closed.
The judge smirked in Clint's direction as he walked out the side door, unable to believe what had just happened. Clint sat down heavily in his chair, staring at the door the Plover had just exited. Just as stunned, the sheriff looked down at him, wide-eyed with shock.
Damn, boy. He threw everything but the kitchen stove at you. He sure had it in for you.
Clint didn't speak for a few moments, still trying to right his tumbled mind. Then he looked up at Bridges.
It was his horse I stole.
The rest of that day was a tornado of conflicting thoughts that left Clint in a state of despair. Feeling betrayed by Clayton as well as the vengeful judge, he cursed himself for allowing the marshal to bring him back to Cheyenne. Thinking he'd been sentenced unfairly the first time, he had permitted himself to be persuaded to seek restitution from the court, aided by his deeds of compassion for the officers of the law. Looking back, now that it was too late, he thought himself a fool for swallowing Clayton's promises of redemption. Sheriff Bridges was quite contrite about the heavy sentence Plover had laid down for his young prisoner, and he tried to make up for it somewhat by arranging for a special supper from the hotel kitchen. Clint ate only a small portion of it. Clayton came to visit him just before supper, even though he explained to Clint that he had been trying to gain an audience with Judge Wingate all afternoon. He could see the complete reversal of Clint's attitude toward him. Growing more bitter by the minute, Clint did not respond, sitting glassy-eyed on his cot until Clayton left. Later that evening, the sheriff came in to see him. With him, Clint saw a big, raw-boned man wearing a deputy's badge.
This here's Roy Speed, one of my deputies. He'll be escorting you on the noon train to Laramie tomorrow morning.
In contrast to the sheriff, Spade eyeballed Clint with a curled lip look of contempt. He stepped up close to the bars of Clint's cell.
Just so you know, Jailbird, I don't tolerate no trouble from Jaspers like you. So it's up to you. We can have us a peaceable little ride up to Laramie if you behave. If you don't, I'll break a gun barrel across your skull and deliver you in a box. You got that?
He waited for Clint's response. Several minutes passed without one, save the unwavering glare of the prisoner's eyes.
You just remember what I told you.
The next day it was Sheriff Bridges as well as Zach Clayton who brought Clint his breakfast, and they sat talking to him while he ate. Overnight, Clint had thought about what had happened and realized that he had probably been wrong in thinking Clayton betrayed him. Still, he had abandoned all hope of having Plover's decision reversed, and the prospect of 10 more years in prison loomed before him as the end of all the dreams he had allowed himself during the past few weeks. About a half hour before noon, Roy Speed came in.
Where the hell have you been? I told you to be here 30 minutes ago.
Hell, it's still half an hour before the train gets here, if it's on time. It don't take but 10 minutes to walk to the station.
Roy took the cell key off a peg and went to Clint's cell, grinning at Bridges as he walked by.
Have you been drinking?
Hell no. I stopped in the Silver Dollar for one little shooter this morning, and that's all.
Bridges was still suspicious, but it was too late to do anything about it if Spade had been drinking. His other deputy had gone out to check on a report of cattle thieves operating near the Rocking M Ranch. He watched Spade pull Clint's hands behind his back and cuff him. He seemed steady enough, so the sheriff decided Spade was probably telling him the truth.
Come on, Jailbird.
Spade grabbed Clint by the arm and gave him a forceful shove. It was only a short walk to the end of the street and the train depot. The train for Laramie pulled in at about 25 after 12, which the station master maintained was pretty much on time for the noon train. Spade led Clint down the track to the last car. The first step was knee high, and with his hands behind his back, Clint couldn't lift up on it.
Come on, come on. You can't get up there?
I can't sit down in a seat with my hands behind my back anyway. If you handcuff me with my hands in front, I can grab the handrail and get on the train, and I can sit down after we get on.
Did I ask you anything? You think you're the first son of a bitch I've had to take to Laramie? Turn around!
He spun Clint around roughly, grabbed his wrist, and unlocked the cuff. Roy spun him back around to face him.
Stick your damn hands up here.
It happened faster than Spade's alcohol-addled brain could react. Clint brought his hands up as he had been ordered, but to Spade's surprise, his own revolver was in one of them, the barrel looking him in the face.
What the?
Spade slapped his hand on his empty holster. Stunned by the suddenness of Clint's move, Spade stared wide-eyed at the ominous pistol muzzle aimed at his eye. He made no move to resist when Clayton took the key from his fingers.
You ain't getting away with this, you damn fool!
Shut up. Put your hand in the cuff. Make no mistake about it, I'll blow a hole in your head before I go back to that prison.
The resolve in his eye convinced Spade that he meant what he said. The deputy stuck his hand out and Clint closed the cuff around his wrist. Then he pulled the other cuff through the handrail.
Put your other hand in there.
You can't do that.
I ain't gonna be handcuffed to no damn train.
You'd rather be shot down beside it? All the same to me.
He pressed the pistol against Spade's forehead.
Wait! Wait, damn it!
Spade held up his wrist. Clint locked the cuff and stepped back.
All aboard!
We'll hunt you dead for this. You're as good as dead.
Clint shoved the deputy's pistol in his belt.
You're a pretty big asshole, but I don't know if you're man enough to hold back a train. I'd say you best hop up on that step unless you want to be dragged to Laramie.
Suddenly, the passenger cars started slowly rolling, leaving Spade no choice but to leap aboard. Clint, taking care to walk unhurriedly back, went around behind the jail and proceeded to the end of the street and the stables. Entering the rear of the stable, he pulled Spade's pistols from his belt and stopped just inside the door, scanning the interior of the building. The owner, who had seen Clint and Clayton when they had left Rowdy to be boarded, was nowhere in sight. Instead, the stable was left in the care of a boy of 16 or 17. Clint stuck the pistol back in his belt. Walking nonchalantly between the stalls, he approached the boy.
I've come to pick up a horse, that buckskin yonder in the corral. Sheriff Bridges sent me to get the horse. Belonged to a prisoner that just left on the noon train. There ought to be a saddle in the tack room. I'll get it.
He walked on past the hesitant boy on his way to the tack room.
Well, hop to it, boy. The sheriff said right away.
Mr. Bailey's gone to dinner. He ought to be back pretty soon.
Don't have time to wait for Bailey. He knows about it anyway. Sheriff Bridges will be by to make it right. Now, how about helping me out and cut that buckskin out of there? I'm kind of in a hurry.
Deciding that it must be all right if the sheriff sent the stranger over, the boy hopped over the rails. He watched as Clint saddled Rowdy.
That Winchester and the gun belt was supposed to be took over to the sheriff's office. I was fixing to do it today.
Don't worry about it. I'll see that it gets where it's supposed to.
Clint stepped up in the saddle and wheeled Rowdy around.
You say Sheriff Bridges is coming by to settle with Mr. Bailey?
Oh, I guarantee you, Bridges will be by.